for today is the period of the judges, an overview. First of all, we need to take a look at this term, the period of the judges. This describes briefly the period from Joshua's death until the anointing of the first king, King Saul. And the reason why we usually call it, or writers usually refer to this period by this particular name, is because the leading figures in this period of time are called, at least in our English translation, judges. And since these are the leading figures, this is the term we usually use to describe this period. Another name that would be very accurate for describing this particular period would be the term the tribal period. Not that Israel ceased to be a collection of tribes at a later period of time, because they always preserved their tribal identifications. But in this particular period, it is quite evident that there was very little unity. There was very little common action taken by the tribes outside of the war against the Benjaminites that focused against the city of Gibeah. There was practically no single military activity prior to the time of Samuel where you have all the tribes involved together in fighting any kind of particular battle after they've settled in the land. And so it was literally a period, whereas the last verse of the book describes it, where every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And the same thing said could be said about each of the tribes, pretty much. So it was a very decentralized period in Israel's history. And so therefore, this is a very appropriate term for it. Now, before we get into the general overview of the period itself, we need to see what has transpired just prior to the inauguration of the period, which, of course, we don't really officially begin it until after we have the death of Joshua. So let's take up this homework assignment that I asked you to complete, where I wanted you to read through Joshua 1 through 11, and, of course, Joshua 12 is sort of a summary chapter of these activities, and compare it to the first chapter of Judges. Now, who would like to state a generalization for the benefit of the class as to what the contrast is between Judges 1 through 12 and, I'm sorry, Joshua 1 through 12 and Judges the first chapter? Who can pinpoint the essential contrast? Did anyone else get that viewpoint? I don't think that is what those passages imply. You're right about after Jericho they turn south, and that takes them through chapter 10, but then chapter 11 takes them up into the north, you see. Now, Judges chapter 1, I don't think, implies they did nothing in the south. But it does show us another contrast, though. Daniel? Okay. Daniel is highlighting the fact that the time setting of Judges chapter 1, and this is very important, is after the death of Joshua, as the first verse tells us, you see. So chapter 1 describes the situation that exists after the death of Joshua. Now, how does that represent a contrast So Judges chapter 1 through 11, or even if you include 12, which is sort of the summary. Got a complete mental block. Go ahead. I can't think this morning. Go ahead. Okay, this is one of the contrasts, and that's why we say we call this the tribal period, that after the death of Joshua, there doesn't seem to be any unity at all. And we'll see that when we get down into the leaders we call judges, which may or may not be the best name for them, or title for them, that you don't have any judge really prior to Samuel that seems to have an overall influence over the entire country. And that we have to be very careful of these phrases, all Israel, because they don't always mean all Israel in the all-inclusive sense. The term all Israel sometimes means all the tribes. Sometimes it means the northern tribes only. Sometimes it means the Jews. So it depends on its usage. You have to always take it from context. That's very different from the phrase house of Israel, which always means just the northern collection of tribes, because that's a different kind of a term. But what's another contrast that we have here, I think? We still haven't hit, though, the single most important. This was an interesting contribution and an important one, but I think there's one that's even more important. Mrs. Bradick? Okay, so the contrast in achievement, even where they were victorious in the case of the book of Judges, they still haven't completely eliminated these people. They're living in among them. This is an important one, too. But I think there's still something we haven't touched upon that represents a dramatic contrast. We've got two very good ones, but we haven't gotten to, I think, the most critical. Yes?
Is it that Judah begins to take the lead in setting the pace for the rest of the tribes? Because in verse 2 of Judges, it says that God says Judah shall go up. And Judah seems to be exalted on the people, but it says Ephraim didn't do that.
Well, let's not read too much into the Ephraim did not, because it gives some of the positive accomplishments of Judah, and then it begins to focus rather heavily on the things the other tribes did not accomplish to make a certain point. It doesn't imply that they had no success whatsoever. Let's be careful about that. The purpose of the first chapter is to highlight the lack of success in occupying the land God had promised. And then, of course, chapter 2 explains why they had the lack of success. Now, again, we wouldn't write a story that way. We wouldn't write about the lack of success and then explain it after the fact. But that's the way we have it in the Bible, because that was just stylistically the way they did it. But I think we're still not really zeroing in on it. David? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny though that no one has mentioned, I think, what is the most critical thing, is notice how chapter 11 ends. Of Joshua, obviously, since we're talking about Joshua 1 to 11. So Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord said to Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance to Israel, according to their divisions by their tribe, and the land rested from war. And if you go back to chapter 10, in verse 40, it talks about how Joshua smote all the country of the hills, and of the south, and of the vale, and of the springs, and all their kings, and he left none remaining, but utterly destroyed all that breathed, as the eternal Lord of Israel commanded. And then, after the listing of all these kings in chapter 12, we open chapter 13, or rather we go to Judges chapter 1, and we find they haven't yet even occupied the land. So there seems to be a discrepancy here. Joshua takes everything and divides it up, and then we first find them going out and taking possession again after his death, years later. Something seems out of joint. And I think we need to see how this fits together. Now, chapter 13 of Joshua, talking about Joshua, says that he was old and stricken in years. I love this. Joshua was old and stricken in years, and the Eternal said to him, "You are old and stricken in years." Now, we wouldn't write that way, now, would we? That's just a stylistic point, the way the Bible is written, you see. Seems rather funny to our ears today, because we don't write that way. He says, "And there remains yet very much land to be possessed." So you see, it's giving us an illustration of something that sometimes when the Bible uses seemingly all-inclusive statements, we have to take it as less than meaning the way we would use these words. And we will see illustrations of that in the book of the Judges, where that is sometimes even clarified in a succeeding verse. So in Joshua 10, verse 40, where it says that he smote all the country of the hills and of the south and of the vale and of the springs and all their kings, that, first of all, he's only talking about the south of the country, because that's the focus of the activity of chapter 10. We have to keep it in its proper context. And what it's referring to is not necessarily every little town and every little village and every little hamlet, you know, was mopped up. What it's meaning to tell us is, just as the slide we've been looking at for the past several days indicates, is that Joshua focused his activity against major centers in the hill country and the land of the springs, which would be the Shephelah, and in the valleys in between them, taking out these major centers. Took out these major centers. In that sense, this was all inclusive in this southern area. It doesn't mean to imply he destroyed every settlement of Canaanites. Otherwise, there would have been none left at that point. Now, in Joshua chapter 11, at the end of the chapter, where it says that he took the whole land, I think what we have to see in that, in these campaigns, is that as a result of his activity, all organized opposition to the Israelites and their settlement was eliminated, because he had taken all the major centers of Canaanite influence and population. There was nothing at that point which would have prevented the Israelites from settling wherever they wished amongst the remaining Canaanites, and then succeeding in driving out the remaining ones in a continuing process, because all the key centers had been destroyed. Remember that following the battle at the waters of Merom in the north, Joshua destroyed all of the cities here in the north, though he only chose to burn Hazor, and he had already taken care of the situation in the south. And so, you know, now the land basically was without any organized opposition. The problem is that they had taken out these chief centers of influence, but as chapter 13 says, there was still a lot of the land to actually be physically possessed. You might say the mopping up operations had not yet been accomplished. The major campaigns had been accomplished, but the mopping up and the consolidation of the victories what still lay ahead, and that represented a very large task. Now the problem was, when did the Israelites get busy in following up on Joshua's opening blitz? Well, according to the Bible, when did they get busy in doing that? After Joshua was dead. Now, why the Israelites waited so long, the Bible does not address that question. The Bible does not address the question as to why they waited so long, which unfortunately, because they waited so long, allowed the Canaanites or other Canaanites that survived to reoccupy these strategic locations and reestablish these cities, therefore making their task much more difficult. we are left without a specific answer as to why they waited. Now, in Judges chapter 1, we read about the fact that though they had some success, there were a significant number of cities that they did not occupy. Now, we've seen a slide that shows this relationship, but in addition, I can distribute this map so that you would have a permanent record of it, which shows the areas they succeeded in occupying and the areas they did not succeed in occupying. And this map is based primarily on the information in Judges chapter 1, although there is also an attempt to correlate that with archaeological findings as to where we find traces of Israelite settlement and where we find predominantly Canaanite settlement. So we'll let this get distributed, and then we'll take a look at this map together. This is difficult to say. We estimate that it took about 5, maybe 7 years for Joshua to accomplish his complete campaign, and how much he lived after that, it's not too clear. And so we only have a fuzzy idea of how long this waited. You have to remember, too, that the nature of the land of Canaan was not like Southern California in terms of intensity of settlement. You had towns with maybe some suburban villages around them, and then you had huge areas of empty space before you came to the next major town with its collection of villages. And so you have lots of unoccupied land. The population of Canaan at this time is estimated to have been quite thin, based on the size of the cities, you see. Remember that even at the time that David conquered Jerusalem, the city only had about 2,000 inhabitants or 2,500 inhabitants. But except for Hazor in the north, cities average probably 1,000 people or less in terms of its number of inhabitants. And a lot of the country was empty. And in fact, one of the complaints of the tribe of Joseph to Joshua while he still lived, you know, when he was dividing, as God inspired him to do, the land into their portions, is that they came to him and said that, I think it's here in, find it here, 16. Yeah, 16. 17. Oh, yes. Chapter 17 of Joshua, verse 14. The children of Joseph said to Joshua, "Why have you given me but one lot and one portion to inherit, seeing am I a great people? For as much as the Eternal has blessed me up to this point." And Joshua answered, "If you be a great people, then get up into the wood country and cut down for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites and of the giants, and if Mount Ephraim be too narrow for you." You see, a lot of the land was heavily wooded, and therefore there wasn't a lot of people living in those areas. You had a lot of extensive forest areas. And so you've got to get away from maybe a mental image of a place which is as densely populated as, they say, this area of Southern California, which seems like one small town adjoins another, and there's very little open space in between. You've got these people pretty thinly spread out. Now, you all have the maps by this time, and I think you can notice a number of very key cities on the map that are mentioned in Judges chapter 1 as not having been conquered. First of all, Jebus, which is the name for Jerusalem in this period. You can see how it sort of cuts right in there into the center of the Israelite area of settlement. Then Gezer, slightly to the west. Then going north, we have Aphek. And along the coast, we have Dor. And then in the Jezreel Valley area, we have Megiddo and Tanakh. And in the eastern end of the Jezreel Valley, we have Bet-Shan. And then we have most of the area of the northern Galilee, with the exception of Dan, remain outside of their control. Now, why is it that since God had promised the land to them, that they came to possess less than all of it? Now, some of you have traveled in this area, and I think are aware of the fact that based on the map we have here, that most of the best land is not in Israelite control. The Israelites are in rather inferior portions when you take all the land here of Canaan as a unit. So they have only inherited a portion of what God promised, and they haven't even inherited the best portions of what God promised. Why the lack of success? And the answer is given very explicitly in chapter 2, Judges chapter 2, where it says that an angel of the Eternal came up from Gilgal to Bochim. It's an interesting situation here again, stylistically. This is not a place which always was known as Bochim. It became known as Bochim because of what happened in the next few verses. And yet it's called Bochim before the name really begins to apply. They came up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, I made you to go up out of Egypt, and I brought you unto the land which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. Of course, that was a conditional statement here, as far as possession. Because it says, you shall make no league with the inhabitants of this land, and you shall throw down their altars. Now, if you want some scriptures just to take note of, you might put this down in the margin. Because this is where God commanded them to do these things. In Exodus chapter 23, in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 2, in Deuteronomy 12, verses 2 and 3, you find these commands God gave them not to make any alliances with these people, and everywhere they found their pagan altars to throw them down. So what is the complaint of this angel of the Eternal? You have not obeyed my voice. Ergo, what had the Israelites done? They had failed to throw down the altars, and rather than keeping themselves separate, they had made alliances with the Canaanites. Now, the question might come up, could this simply be a reference to their alliance with the Gibeonites, into which they were tricked in the first place? And it would seem that that would be insufficient, that God would hold them so generally responsible for having been tricked into making an alliance with one small group of people. It seems that they were involved much more extensively with these people than just the limited situation with Gibeon. So therefore I say, I will not drive them out from before you, but they shall be as thorns in your sides, and their gods shall be a snare to you. Now, when is the time? What is the time setting of this pronouncement? This might have even been the being who became Jesus Christ personally appearing to them, and as he had to Joshua earlier, and telling them this piece of information. What is the time setting? I don't mean give me a year. What period are we talking about? Yeah, because in this very instance, we find that Joshua is still alive. So you see, in the organization of the book of Judges, it represents an interesting organization. Chapter 1 is sort of a general summary of conditions. From the time of the death of Joshua through most of the period, sort of just describes the entire period, gives you that overview of what happened after the death of Joshua and then what existed as the situation the Israelites found themselves in throughout the period. Then you get to chapter 2 and you have the cause of this situation. So in other words, they've been lollygagging about and not being very forceful in following up on the victories God gave them through Joshua, and contrary to the commands of God, even where they established themselves, they have not destroyed the Canaanites utterly, and they have not torn down their altars. Instead, they have intermingled with them. And so God tells them, because you've done this, you're not going to be given any further major successes. You're just not going to have all the land. But I'm going to leave these people here as potential snares for you, and their gods shall remain as a potential snare for you. So this is the thing that they would suffer from. Notice, too, that they, as chapter 2 indicates, sort of as a preamble to the specific details that are provided about some of the judges, this general pattern of the Israelite behavior. It says here in verse 10 of chapter 2 that all the generation were gathered to their fathers, the generation of Joshua. And there arose another generation that knew not the Eternal, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel, at least not by personal experience. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Eternal and served Balaam. Actually, it should be translated, they served the Baals, because Balaam is not a single deity, it's plural. Served the various Baal gods. And they forsook the Lord God of their fathers, which brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they followed other gods, of the gods of the people that were round about them, and they bowed themselves down to them and provoked the Eternal to anger. They forsook the Lord and served Baal and Ashtaroth. Again, Ashtaroth is a plural, the Astartes. And the anger of the Eternal was hot against Israel, and he delivered them into the hands of spoilers that spoiled them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies round about, so they could no longer stand before their enemies. You see. And then, of course, when they would begin to repent, God would send them a deliverer. And then what would happen after they had been relieved of the oppression? They would simply, after the judge was dead, they would go back into the same sort of behavior. This is something that they constantly were doing. Now, why is it that these gods proved an ever-constant snare to the Israelites? Why is it that they were always falling away into worshiping the various Baals and worshiping the various Astartes? Why didn't they just see that that didn't bring good results and just wash their hands of it and say never again? Obviously, there was a powerful attraction in the worship of these gods. We have to understand the mentality of the people. Something I've already referred to is that there was a common belief in gods being localized, and that a god was powerful on his own soil. What's one example of that concept of a god being powerful on his own soil that I've already given to you? William? Right. Now recall that when he was convinced that the God of Israel was really a god who deserved to be worshipped, he knew he was going home to Aram, so he wanted some Israelite earth to be given to him so he could worship the God of Israel in Aram, because he couldn't conceive of how he could worship the God of Israel on Aramean earth. You see, this is, of course, a false concept, but this was something that was very deeply rooted. And so the Israelites, not being called and converted as a nation, as Mr. Armstrong has hit that point very strongly in recent years, because it's a misunderstood point by many who call themselves Christian. They regard the fact that God worked with Israel as a whole nation, and they failed him, and so he rejected them, you see. Cast them off and chose a different people for himself. God never worked with them as a nation, giving them the opportunity to, as a nation, to understand his purposes or to be called and to have his spirit. They reflected these ideas. They are living in the land of Canaan, on the soil of Canaan. Is it wise to ignore the gods of Canaan? is it wise to ignore the gods who are powerful on this soil, to just have no regard to them at all? And the conclusion of the masses of Israelites was no. It is not wise to ignore these gods that are powerful on this soil. We should give them some attention so that we do not offend them and bring their curses upon us, and maybe we can secure their support as well. Even though they had been warned about this, they felt compelled over and over and over again to do this. Now, in what way were the people a snare to them? What way were the people a snare to them? Well, if we go back to Judges chapter 1, we can find that because they did not succeed in driving out all of the Canaanites, especially from their major strongholds, what condition obtained? Notice in Judges 1, verse 21, we have one such instance. The children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites that inhabited Jerusalem, but the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem unto this day. You see, you've got a very close association here in this regard. And I'm trying to see if there's another mention of this particular thing specifically, but this is the general pattern that one finds, even culturally speaking, in many of these centers, is you find a mixture of Canaanite and Israelite culture. Now, this is not surprising when you consider the fact that the Israelites and the Canaanites were essentially distinguished by only one thing. The Israelites worshiped Yahweh and the Canaanites didn't. That essentially is the only distinction you can make between these Canaanites and the Israelites. The Israelites worshiped Yahweh and the Canaanites did not. That in all other essential aspects of material culture, the Israelites are not easily separated from their Canaanite neighbors. And so when you're living so much like the others, it is quite a struggle to keep your religion separate as well. And because of the concern about a God being powerful on his own soil, even in this area, the Israelites were not that eager to keep themselves separate. Now, there were two features of Canaanite worship that God said he particularly hated. What were those two features that God continually condemns that were associated intimately with Canaanite religious worship? Yes?
Putting the children to the fire.
Okay, child sacrifice. And what was the other? Well, idolatry is mentioned, of course, the fact of bowing down to something of stone or of wood. But there was another particular practice which God specifically singles out for major condemnation as a specific part of this idolatrous worship. Neil? Pardon? Well, those are just, again, like the idolatry of worship, yes. Ritual prostitution. These two things come in for a lot of attention and condemnation. And yet both of them are essentially the same in purpose. You say, well, what does child sacrifice have to do with ritual prostitution? It seems like totally removed. But they're actually different sides of the same coin once we understand why the Canaanites practiced them. Both of them involve the same phenomenon, which is known as sympathetic magic. The idea that the universe is divided into two planes. You have the cosmic plane, in which you have the gods, and then you have the earthly plane, in which you have man. Man desires certain things to take place on the earthly plane. Let's take something very basic. Man desires that the soil be fertile. And that he have sufficient rain for his crops. Especially in a land like Canaan, because you have no Nile River to provide constant water that you can use for irrigation. If it rains, you have successful crops. If it doesn't rain, you don't. How did God use this fact in his dealings with Israel? What did he tell them? That they were rain dependent. Well, how can you tell just from what God promised or threatened, that they were to be a rain-dependent people? Yeah, and he says, if you don't obey me, what would he do? What is the specific thing? I shut up heaven, he says, your earth shall be like iron and your heaven is brass. You see, it's not going to rain. You see, you get these dust clouds in the atmosphere and they will yield nothing. Because, as I say, this is a rain-dependent area. So this is what man was interested in. Now, in their religion, they saw Baal as the storm god and Astarte was the goddess of the soil fertility. And in their thinking, they made an obvious association that what in essence they want is for the rain to interact with the soil to produce crops, that the soil may yield crops abundantly. And so what they want is for Astarte and Baal to be doing what they're supposed to be doing, providing the rain and the fertility of the soil. Now, sympathetic magic involves doing something on an earthly plane that you believe will force the gods to do something on the cosmic plane. See, the essence of magic is an attempt to gain control over forces you normally cannot control and which are more powerful than you. That's the essence of magic of any kind, is the attempt to control forces which you normally cannot control and which are more powerful than you. And so this is an attempt to control the actions of Baal and Astarte, to compel them to do what you would like by using magic. And it's called sympathetic magic. You know what sympathy is. When you have sympathy, or more properly maybe empathy, what does that mean with another individual? What does that mean? Sympathy more in the sense of sympathetic vibrations would be more accurate rather than the way we think of it as an emotion. But let's deal with empathy as an emotion. Either one, yes. Yeah. That you, this person is feeling a certain way and it creates inside of you the same emotional feeling. In terms of physical science, you'd call it, you resonate. You see. You're both hitting the same note. That's what we call sympathetic vibration, when something is vibrating over here at a certain speed, producing a certain tone, something else is vibrating in the same speed, in the same tone. You see, so they're connected that way. So this is why it's called sympathetic magic, because man will attempt to do something down here that will produce the equivalent up here. And what is it that ritual prostitution involves? A male worshiper and a female priestess. The female priestess represents Astarte, and the male is made to represent Baal. So if this is carried out as a ritual thing on earth, it is powerful magic and will bind Baal to cause Astarte to become fertile, and therefore the soil will yield. Notice it's a totally different concept than what God lays down. Be obedient, and I promise you, you will be blessed. In other words, choose to be obedient in faith that I will deliver what I have promised. Here, there's no attempt involved in obedience. It is simply an attempt to force the gods to obey what man would like done. And you can understand why God would not like it. Beyond the fact that God would not approve of ritual prostitution anyway, it's the whole theory behind the thing. The idea that man can compel God to do something. That man can get God over a barrel or put him in his pocket. That is what God specifically, I think, was most angry about. That whole approach to God. And if we're not careful, we can attempt to use prayer in the same way or our own obedience to his commandments in the same way. You see, if we're not careful, we can drift into an attitude that's pretty close to that, that we can use our obedience to his commandments or prayer as a club over God in some fashion too. Now, how is this similar to child sacrifice? Well, that's again a form of sympathetic magic. The theory behind that being that if an individual gives up that which is most precious to him, and that would usually be a firstborn son in this society, that the God is therefore compelled to answer the request of the person who offered the sacrifice. But in other words, it's a way of gaining power again over the God to compel the God to act in the way you want. I think I already gave you an illustration of that in operation, how even Israel was affected by that. When we, in 2 Kings, where Israelites were attacking the king of Moab, and right in the sight of the Israelite army and their Edomite allies, he sacrificed his oldest son, offering up as a burnt offering on the wall of the city so they could see it, rather than in the temple. He wanted them to know what he was doing. Not by word of mouth, but to see it. And they became convinced that they couldn't win any longer. Because after all, they weren't on Israelite soil, they were on Moabite soil. And the king of Moab had offered his most precious thing to his Moabite god. He was bound to answer, so why continue? It was bound to end in disaster, so he might as well go home. And the Edomites were very angry that the Israelites and their activity had pushed the king of Moab to such an extremity, you see, as the text says. There was very, very strong belief in this. It was believed to be very powerful magic because that which was most precious had been offered. We need to keep that idea in mind that the purpose of child sacrifice was to offer that which was most precious to compel the God to do what you wanted. To keep that in the back of our minds because we will take up that concept in connection with Jephthah later. Because you'll see that Jephthah, in a way, applied it, but in a very interesting distortion, which is probably why he ended up in the mess that he ended up with. It wasn't just the idea that Jephthah had that made God angry, it was the way he even went about the idea, which we'll take up later. Somebody had a hand waving, yes, Ken? This is where these concepts, this is hard to say. They may have carried that from Egypt, or this may have been implanted in them when they came here. There's no way you can tell from anything we've uncovered archaeologically or anything in the Bible. Yeah?
You mentioned that the differences between the Israelites and the Canaanites were not that great. How about racially? Was there a great difference racially?
Apparently not. Because all of our representations of Canaanites show them to be heavily bearded and show them to be swarthy, about as you are, but no more. Or maybe slightly more so, but not much. Not much so. Yeah. And there was a great deal of intermarriage among them. You see, the Bible gives testimony to that there was a consistent problem. of them taking their daughters for themselves, for their sons, and of giving their daughters to the Canaanites. There's a great deal of both marriage both ways. Okay, very quickly, I wanted to read you this description of child sacrifice that is given in Mishnah's book, The Source. Well, it depends which edition you have. Paperback or hardcover. Oh, I don't have time for that. Okay. I'll do it next time. There's something else I need to cover next time anyway, so...